Well, my husband David is an avid reader. He's always very ahead in reading, and I kind of get the secondary catch-up of what he's reading. He often tells me some of the stories, and he was recently telling me about the biography he was reading on Jonathan Swift, who wrote Gulliver's Travels, spent a lot of his time as a vicar in different parts of Ireland, but there's a very sad moment towards the end of the biography where he knows his mind is beginning to deteriorate. And he's out walking with some of his friends, and he sees on the roadside a tree, and it's very striking because lightning has struck the tree and there's a big fissure at the top of the tree. The roots and the trunk are fine, but from the top down you can see death slowly creeping in to the tree. And that was the moment where Jonathan Swift began to realize, that's me. And he wept uncontrollably at this realization. This is what's happening. And he had to begin to try and explain to his walking companions what was going on in that moment of painful awakening. And in our story that we read today, The Road to Emmaus, there's this splitting apart, but it's of almost the opposite kind of what Swift had, because the head knowledge, it's all intact, but it no longer connects with the reality of the disciples' experience. And the only way to get their lives back is resurrection and this remembering, this putting back together again for a fresh encounter with the person of Jesus. But there's this interesting tension, isn't there, in this story building up, because we know Jesus is the one traveling alongside these disciples, but the awakening doesn't happen until right at the end. Do you ever wonder why it took Jesus so long to reveal himself to his disciples? It was not until the breaking of bread. But I think the longer we sit with this wonderful story, we begin to get a sense of the mission strategy and the purpose of Jesus in his kingdom work, that it's not just about having the correct facts, but it's about this living relationship and communion with his people. So it's resurrection day still. It's now heading towards the evening. This couple are heading probably towards their home on the road to Emmaus, 7 miles. The tomb is empty, but they have this really painful disconnect between a Messiah who seems further away from their lives than ever. And these disciples, all they feel they can do is wander home. And yet their conversation has all the language of legitimacy to it. When you hear them narrate the events of Jesus, they're describing that he was a prophet, mighty in word and deed. We had hoped he was going to redeem Israel. And it's the third day since all this took place. Well, all this is very accurate, isn't it? In fact, the verb in verse 15 used to describe how they were recounting the details is homileo, which helps us describe the sermon, the homilies. So they're giving each other mini sermons. All the details are right. These are the words the apostles themselves are going to use later on in Acts to preach to the Gentiles. And the conversation is highly tense. It's charged. They're emotional. They're wearing each other down by this intense debate. What has happened here? What has gone wrong? And isn't it so ironic then that the person they're debating about should come alongside them? And they're kept from recognizing who he is. This radical disconnect between their head knowledge and their experience of Resurrection Day. And when we read this story, I wonder, did you this morning feel just a little bit of frustration with the disciples? We have been placed with the benefit of knowing that the stranger who accompanies them is Jesus. How could they have missed that? And Dr. Luke lets us sit in this really entitled position of dramatic irony where we know more than the actual characters. And I wonder if for a moment you thought to yourself, expending myself in a wearisome debate about the meaning and purpose of Jesus' life and yet missing out on recognizing Jesus, I would never do that. And yet, imagine if you were to come up to me and say, you're married to David, aren't you? Tell me a little bit about him. And I give you a book that is a biography of David's life. Chapter 1, the early years of David. And chapter 2, his education, where he went to school and what he enjoyed studying. The places he excelled. Chapter 3, his sporting career as a rugby player and all the famous matches. Chapter 4, his evolving style. That's a short chapter. He's teaching little lambs. I know I can get away with it. But after my friends read the book, they say, well, that's all good, but what is he actually like? And I say, well, I haven't actually met him. This is the book about David Campbell. That would seem strange, wouldn't it? Because I'm married to him. I know him. I know what he's fully like. And it's the same with God. His purpose is for us to know him, not just to read the book about him, but to have this living communion with Jesus Christ, to really know him, to have this wonderful awakening of who he is. Jesus wanted to open eyes. He wanted to stretch their minds. He wanted their hearts to be burning within them. And this required an altogether different pastoral approach than Jesus just turning up and saying, I'm back, here I am. He needed a very subtle ministry. And the starting pastoral approach is one of accompaniment, accompanying these disciples along the road. These disciples probably assumed Jesus was just another worshiper like them, trying to get home. So he lets him walk alongside them. Now, one of my favorite TED Talks is by a Christian musician called Chris Blake. For years, Chris was a professional horn player with the Ulster Orchestra, but then he kind of took a second career as an accompanist in a school with children who had very severe learning disabilities. And he said it's through that challenge he learned how to be a good accompanist. Because as a musician, there's 50 different ways you can bring the best out of a piece of music. But when you accompany someone else, you have to make this decision to deny a bit of yourself and set a bit of yourself aside in order to hear what the other person is doing and then make decisions about how to bring the best out of them. And you look for the cues that they give in order to get this good framework of how to let the music really flourish and sing. And all that is more challenging when you've little children who have such severe difficulties that they can't communicate and speak, they can't even read. So how can you direct them to learn music when, if you point to a piece of music, their attention is elsewhere? And Chris describes this wonderful story of a little girl he was working with who came into the room, and she was severely autistic, so the eye contact wasn't there. She couldn't speak, and she was wandering around this room and looking at things and letting her attention settle on different parts of the room. And then Chris noticed her go over to the window, and as she was looking out the window, she put her fingers on the window ledge and started to walk her fingers like that. And Chris took a risk at that stage. He began to go to the piano and play music in time to the walk of her fingers. And something happened with that little girl. She was hearing the music, and so she stopped. And Chris stopped playing. And then she started walking again, and he joined in, went a little bit faster, and he went a little bit faster, and they began to develop this relationship with each other. And then over the course of building relationship, and 3 years later, this little girl who couldn't read was singing, she'd memorized 24 Disney songs and was able to sing them perfectly. Now, isn't that beautiful? Isn't that something about the power of accompaniment, of drawing alongside? And this is what Jesus was doing with us as disciples who couldn't get there on our own. We needed someone to gently come in. And Jesus didn't impose himself on these disciples. He picked up the pace that they were going with. He picked up on what they were talking about. What are you discussing about? And he lets them tell him all about himself and what he's done. And then he comes in. He lets them talk about their disappointment with their own leaders, how they felt let down that these leaders handed Jesus over to Rome. He lets them disclose their cynicism about the supernatural. These women have this vision over here about the tomb and the angels. And he lets them repeat their recurring theme. We need evidence. We need hard, factual evidence that Jesus is alive. And the irony is, there is Jesus all this time standing right in front of them. This is the evidence. And yet Jesus doesn't reveal himself at that moment. Instead, he connects in to that site of where they had first begun, with the mind, and he appeals to their mind. How slow you are, he says, to believe all that the prophets had spoken. And Jesus is emphasizing that word, all that the prophets had spoken, because he was trying to stretch their vision. They had really limited Jesus and what he'd come to do. And so Jesus reviewed with them all that the Moses and the prophets had talked about, and how it all pointed to Jesus Christ, and how it was necessary, that word necessary again, for the Messiah to come and suffer in order to get to glory. And that introduction of the word glory begins to connect us to realize glory is about being with God, knowing his presence, experiencing it. But we don't get there yet, because after Jesus works with what they're thinking about, then he appeals to their will as well. He makes as if he's going to travel on, but the disciples are the ones who invite him in. Sure, the day is nearly over, it's getting dark. Why don't you stay with us and have a meal? And you see how all this time Jesus is playing the part of the accompanist, not forcing himself, not setting the pace of events, but letting the disciples make the decision about when to invite him in. I was the stranger, and you invited me in. And after their minds and their wills are engaged, something begins to happen. This inversion takes place. Because all through Jesus' ministry, a big theme of who Jesus is hospitality, sitting down and having food with people. whether it was at weddings, whether it was with the tax collectors, and he loved it so much people were accusing him of being the glutton and the drunkard. And when we think about hospitality in our terms, we often think, well, it's about inviting someone into our home and having them sit down at a meal we've prepared. But Jesus always subverted this pattern because he never had a home that he could invite people into. He was always the guest. And he allowed others to set the menu and set the pace, subverting the rules of hospitality so that no one was going to ever feel indebted to Jesus Christ, for him to reciprocate with generosity. No one was going to ever feel unworthy to sit with Jesus Christ because he was always the guest. It's a beautiful thing. And until that moment in the upper room when the rules get reversed and rather than being the guest, Jesus becomes this host. And as he takes the bread and the wine, he's saying, I'm giving you myself. This is the sacrifice. And I'm presenting it to you. And it's in this moment in the Luke 24 story when Jesus begins to complete those four actions of the upper room where he takes the bread, he blesses the bread, he breaks the bread, and then he gives it to them. That's when they realize this is Jesus, and he's giving himself to us. He's no longer the stranger. He's the Lord. He's Jesus Christ. And what Jesus was doing was using a meal to reconcile the strange exiled parts of these human beings and get them back into the core of who they were, but also to reconcile them to Jesus, that sense of belonging, to be seen. As the little girl said, Daddy, can you see me? That's what was happening. Their eyes were opened. Their hearts were burning. Their minds were stretched. Willie Jennings puts it this way, only an ecclesial practice of difference can make intelligible and redemptive any reflection on and process of change that would draw us ever deeper into God's love and God's power. The witness of the gospel enabled by the Holy Spirit exposes us to the triune God's feverish desire for the creature in all of creation. It's a desire that cannot be abated, will never relent, because it's a consuming fire. I think it would have been so easy for Jesus on Resurrection Day to say, I've done the big work here. I was the one who rose from the dead, and to let the disciples figure it out on their own. But Jesus goes the extra mile, and he comes in and sits at the table to revive the disillusionment of the disciples so that they could come and say, were not our hearts burning within us? Were not our hearts burning within us when he opened the Bible on the Emmaus Road? Their minds, their wills, their hearts had all been reconnected again. But most of all, they had got reconnected to Jesus Christ. And that, my friends, is why he came. That's the purpose, so that we would have relationship and communion with God. Not just the correct head knowledge to hide behind when we get scared or disappointed. God wants more for us, and so word and table are brought together so that we have this extravagant appreciation of the one who's able to raise to life again these skeptics. He doesn't force his way in, but through the art of accompaniment enables human re-engagement with the divine. And each time we practice hospitality, we're offering something of Christ to the stranger. Many of the Celtic monasteries had hospitality right at the core of their identity. There's a lovely story of Bridget, who was daughter to king and queen, and she had this habit of clearing out the kitchen cupboards to give food to the poor. And her mum and dad got so fed up with this habit, they put her out of the castle. And so she went to County Kildare and was one of the first women to found a monastery that was based on hospitality and spreading the aroma of Christ by digging deep into these deep ancient wells of gratitude and all that Christ has done for us. And many of these monasteries were seedbeds to send the monks over into Europe to revive culture, to boost industry, to revolutionize education, all starting with hospitality, sitting with a cup of tea. On Friday, I was at Calvin looking at this wonderful exhibit that some of the students had done. They were in Northern Ireland in January, and their theme was art and reconciliation. And one of the exhibits that they had produced was cups of tea that were empty, but they were dangling down. And the idea was that many of the reconciliation talks started by getting people together around a cup of tea. And that image reminded me of a story one of my parishioners back at home told me. Her husband, in the early 1980s, I think it was caught up in the Teban bombing, and he was killed, he was murdered. She was a young mother with young children, and she said for the next year or so, she was so traumatized. She didn't know how to pick up her life again. And she said the one thing that made a difference was how my predecessor, the Reverend Sam, would come just after the children had got the bus to go to school. He'd be there at the door and walk in straight through to the kitchen, put the kettle on, and they'd sit down with a cup of tea. And she said it was that rhythm that helped me get up in the morning and get going again. And in our communities and societies, hope is in such short supply. We need to be the bearers of this outrageous hope that transformation can take place, because we know the end of the story. We know that Jesus is risen, and the simple art of accompaniment to open people's eyes, to open their hearts, to stretch their minds, that's our calling. You can have the right language and you can know the scriptures well, but you can be like that tree that's struck by lightning where you're beginning to die from the top down. You need this resurrection. And the invitation today is that Jesus is here at this table so that you can meet him here and get your energy back. I find it so striking. If I'd walked 6 miles and I'd sat down to a cup of tea, that would be it. I wouldn't be going any further. But once they meet the risen Jesus and he disappears, they're up on their feet and they're going back 7 miles to tell the disciples. They're not waiting for another night. They're re-energized. The fatigue has vanished. And I love this little touch in this story that sums it up for me, that phrase that comes after the disciples encouraged Jesus to stay. It says, so he went to go in and stay with them. And that phrase pops up one more time in this wonderful story in the Bible. It pops up right at the end in Revelation, where Jesus gives this invitation, even though he's the guest. He says, here I am. I'm standing at the door knocking, and if anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I'm going to come in and eat with them and he with me. So how do you respond to God's feverish desires, consuming fire? Well, before we sing again, I'm going to, as a response, read a poem that talks about this push-pull effect you often have when you get this kind of invitation. It's by George Herbert, and may this be your response to God today. It's called Love, Part 3.
Love bade me welcome, yet my soul drew back, guilty of dust and sin. But quick-eyed love, observing me grow slack from my first entrance in, drew nearer to me, sweetly questioning if I lacked anything. A guest, I answered, worthy to be here. Love said, you shall be he. I, the unkind, the ungrateful. Ah, my dear, I cannot look on thee. Love took my hand and smiling did reply. Who made the eyes but I? Truth, Lord, I've marred them. Let my shame go where it doth deserve, and know you not, says love, who took the blame. My dear, then I will serve. You must sit down, says love, and taste my meat. So I did sit and eat.